invisible man. I'm the invisible man. Incredible how you can see right through me.
Thank you for setting us up, Freddie Mercury. That was Queen, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of April 24th, 2015. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Today on the show, I am not DJing, don't worry. Instead, we are talking about invisibility in all its permutations and what it means in the world and the economy around us. We're going all the way back to Adam Smith and spinning forward to learn about how the military is taking its camouflage inspiration from Squid. Plus, one of the most moving interviews we've ever run, a victim of trafficking tells her story. As always, you can be visible to us. Just go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Go. But before we get invisible, every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog gives you numbers in the news worth watching. Here are our digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with a look at some of the figures we've been tracking this week. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first numbers are
$5.5 million to $7.9 million.
That's how much it could cost Baltimore, Maryland to equip its police officers with body cameras.
And after initially rejecting the proposal, the city is now considering a trial run.
600 points.
That's how much the Dow fell in what became known as the flash crash of 2010. Analysts struggled for a long time to figure out what exactly went wrong.
And now we may have more info. On Tuesday, Navinda Singh Sarau, a British futures trader, was arrested in London. He allegedly manipulated the market, causing the crash.
Number one.
This week, My Idol became the number one entertainment app almost overnight. The Chinese app has been available since February, so its sudden success has a lot of people scratching their heads.
You mean their avatar's head. My Idol is simple. Upload a picture of your face and live vicariously through an avatar. Aw, mine's dancing.
Creepy.
Thanks, guys. And for more of the day's and week's most important stats, you can visit our By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org. Yes, it is April of 2015, but the 2016 election is well underway. Just this week, the Koch brothers, the billionaire conservatives, signaled they may put their money behind Governor Scott Walker. This season, where candidates who may or may not run amass money and buzz, is often called the invisible primary. Some people call it the money primary. It's crucial to campaigns, and it's getting longer, and probably feels more visible, too, especially on the GOP side, where multiple likely candidates are jockeying for money and attention. To tell us more about it, we're joined by Rick Wilson. He's a Republican media consultant based in Florida. He hasn't signed on to any particular campaign yet, but that will likely change. So, Rick, what does the invisible primary look like these days?
There is this underpinning, the story that's being played out mostly outside of the view of the media that involves getting the support for your presidential effort of significant money people, significant communications advisors, and significant players in the states who can help you put together a race. Because, you know, if you're a guy from Florida like Jeb or Marco, you don't go to Iowa with a huge amount of ground knowledge. So you have to find the person out there. So a lot of this is a sort of process of introduction and seduction to bring these folks on board who can put together the state operations that people need, or who can put together, you know, certain coalitions that people need, be it the evangelical side of it or the fiscal conservative side of it.
For your party.
Yes, exactly. You want to play, as I call it, money ball and put together the right team in a smart way. And that doesn't just take writing a check. Sometimes it takes finding a group of people who can come together as a team. You don't just stand in front of a podium anymore with banners and bunting behind you and say, I'm running for president. There's a long run-up to it.
Am I going crazy, or does it feel like this run-up is getting longer and longer and longer? I mean, did it actually stop after the last election?
It never stopped after the last election. And I recall the first conversation I had with someone from one of the campaigns. It's a major campaign now concerning the 2016 election happened 2 days after Mitt Romney was defeated.
Good
Lord. And it was not a trivial conversation. It was an actual sort of game planning thing. And it's remarkable that we live now not in a – we used to call it political cycles. I now call it an ecosystem. It never goes away. It's always there. It's always in the background. It's always the sort of static where people are planning 16 and then 2020 and then 2024 and nigh on into the infinity.
So what makes one candidate break out? Is it just about money?
No, it's not just about money because, you know, money is necessary, but it's not necessarily sufficient. In the way that we live today in politics, where one or two major players can keep a campaign alive and keep them in the fight for a long time, and where one great debate or one great speech or one great performance can take fire on social media and be monetized quickly, you know, we live in a much different world now. And I think the structural things that used to lead to the inevitable, you know, it's his turn, are less relevant now than they were in the past.
It sounds like there's sort of two different storylines. On the one hand, the invisible primary almost never ends. And yet on the other, some of that traditional stuff does matter less and less. So if you are a pro, what are the invisible things that you watch that I don't know about or my mother doesn't know about?
The things that I watch for are what I call fluency. I want to see a Republican candidate who can get out there and operate in front of actual human beings. I want them to be able to sit in a diner in New Hampshire or come to Florida and talk in a town hall meeting. I want them to be able to have mental agility, speed, fluency of issues that are relevant to actual American voters and not just things that we imagine inside the Republican bubble. You know, I don't want to ever have my candidate be so tone deaf to the lives of ordinary Americans that they're unable to connect with them. And I think that we have often been on the wrong side of that equation.
How much cash do they need?
About a billion.
A billion?
For the whole run, about a billion. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, we have seen this skyrocketing cost of escalation inside the Republican – inside of all elections, frankly. I mean, look, we just had a race in the great state of Florida for the governor that was a $130 billion exercise on both sides. So you end up with an
That's
awful
nuts.
Lot of money. Look, all of us are in the wrong business. Buy TV stations because they are making money hand over fist in political season. It's crazy. But I think that you will see this become a billion-dollar campaign operation. It's astounding.
We're talking to you. You're a Republican consultant. Is this different on the Democratic side?
Well, I think it is slightly different on the Democratic side, particularly in this election, because right now there's no real competitive primary being waged, invisible or otherwise, in the Democratic side. Now, that could change. And, you know, we saw in 2008 that Hillary Clinton was absolutely inevitably going to be not only the nominee but president, and that
didn't work out
quite as she expected. But I do think it's a different structure on the Democratic side. However, you know, the rise of super PAC money and of major donor money is transpartisan. It affects both sides. So I think you'll probably see that become a little more prevalent in the future.
Rick Wilson is a Republican media consultant. Rick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Lizzie. I'll talk to you soon.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. When we think about invisibility, there's a lot about technology that we don't see. Yeah, satellites or cable, sure. But recently, beacons have become a big topic in the tech world. They're little, easy to miss. They can be the size of a button. So you probably haven't seen them in their natural habitats. Stores, stadiums, museums, the places people gather. To explain what these things are and why more and more of them keep popping up, we turn to Molly Wood, Marketplace's new senior tech correspondent. Hi, Molly. Welcome.
Thank you, Lizzie. I'm happy to be here.
It's so nice to have you. So, okay, I'm walking into a Major League Baseball stadium. My phone goes bananas. What is happening?
Most likely it is because you've installed a Major League Baseball app or your team's app, and that app is communicating with beacons, which are tiny, low-power radio transmitters placed all over the stadium, and they might be delivering you coupons or VIP upgrade offers.
Can you explain to me how beacons work exactly, and how present are they?
Well, they're actually everywhere. I mean, I think people have no idea how prevalent they are. There are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of them installed in most major cities. They work with Bluetooth, or a specific type of Bluetooth called Bluetooth Low Energy. This is getting a little into the nerd weeds. But what they do is that they don't actually store or transmit any information. They just communicate with your phone. They essentially send this radio signal, and that triggers an activity on your phone. That activity might be popping up a coupon, sending you a message, something like that.
You wrote about this when you were with the New York Times as something that has the obvious advertising tie-ins, but there are potentially other uses, right, as they become more prevalent?
There really are. You know, I mean, I think one thing that's important to remember about beacons is that they can't do anything unless you have opted in or you have an app on your phone that can respond to the beacon. So most likely in the short term, companies are going to start using them for advertising, but they have great potential. For example, in that New York Times story, I talked to a guy who's working with this huge garden that is a big tourist attraction in London.
And Kew Gardens, right.
Kew Gardens, exactly. And so he's doing sort of a storytelling project with Kew Gardens. They're placing beacons throughout the garden, which I think is 300 acres or something like that, somewhere where you couldn't necessarily get cell service. But if you have an app installed on your phone, as you're walking through the garden, you could actually be getting relevant information. It's almost a sort of low-tech version, medium-tech version of augmented reality. And that could happen just about anywhere, at a museum or even on the streets of San Francisco or New York, almost like a virtual sort of tour.
It's very hard not to default, though, to the Minority Report comparison of your phone as a tool for big companies or whomever to sort of funnel information at you all the time as a primed consumer.
That is the obvious example, and that is the most tempting example. And it's really interesting because you find a lot of proponents of beacons who are very worried about that becoming the reality. They say, look, this could be a very useful experience. And even the advertising can be a useful experience. If you love Anthropologie so much that you download their app, and then when you walk into the store, a beacon pops up an ad for you that's completely relevant to you, that's actually kind of great.
Or creepy.
Or creepy. Could be creepy. But if I opt in and I know it's going to happen, then I'm excited instead of creeped out. It's whether apps take that opt-in too far. That's where it starts to be not cool.
Molly Wood is a senior tech correspondent for Marketplace. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're talking about invisibility on today's show, and in the military, invisibility means camouflage. In the past few years, U.S. military uniforms have expanded beyond traditional camo, and we're going to bring in Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer. She's reported from Washington on military uniform spending and how it's changing at the Pentagon. So, Nancy, how much does the U.S. spend on camo uniforms, and where does all that money come from?
You and me, Lizzie. the Government Accountability Office figured all this out. It says the Pentagon spent more than $12 million just to design and develop all these different camouflage patterns, and millions more to actually distribute the uniforms. And eventually, there were at least 10 different uniforms with different camouflage patterns.
So what's the situation now?
Congress kind of put a stop to this. It included a provision on camouflage in the National Defense Authorization Act, which sets the Pentagon's budget. And the act lays out a policy to eliminate the development and fielding of camouflage uniforms designed for just one military branch, with the eventual goal of having everybody wear the same couple of basic designs. Of course, there's no deadline for this. And Congress didn't tell the secretary exactly how many patterns he's allowed to have, and there are exceptions to the rules. So, for example, you can still have different camo patterns for special operations troops.
That sounds like a recipe for figuring this out in the future. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
These days, the Defense Department is interested in something a little more complicated. It's camo inspired by animals, like squid, that can change color to match their surroundings. Producer Eliza Mills went to a chemical engineering lab at the University of California, Irvine. Both the Defense and Energy Departments are funding research there into how a squid protein could help create better camouflage. Eliza spoke to Alon Gorodetsky. He's the chemical engineering professor heading up the research. So let's play some tape.
I have glasses for your own safety. Let's say somebody drops something or there's a spill in that odd chance. You wouldn't want to get it in your eyes. They're precious.
Eliza, we've got you with us now. All right, so you put your goggles on. Tell me what that lab looked like.
The lab was pretty busy. It's full of students. There's a lot going on. Tubes spinning in water, a little bit of fire.
Wait, I'm sorry, fire?
Fire, but it's a confidential project, so I can't tell you any more about it.
Okay. So let's turn to the squid situation here. What exactly are they doing?
They're basically making squid. So picture a squid or an octopus and how sometimes they suddenly change color and disappear into their surroundings.
Okay.
What they're doing at the lab is making the protein called reflectin that let the squid do that. And basically what this protein does is manipulate the light. At the lab, Professor Gorodetsky and his students make a synthetic version of reflectin, so there aren't thousands of dead squid around.
That makes sense.
The centerpiece of the lab is actually a machine that they use to purify this protein.
So here you have a little robotic arm that will go down. It will pick up a vial, and then it'll take a needle, and it'll put the needle in that vial, and then it will inject the protein through this column. It'll come out here, going through a few loops, and then we'll collect it in another vial like this one, and then treat it and process it and use it for coating surfaces.
Coating surfaces. So what does he mean? That basically they've been using kind of stickers, right?
Right. And the refined protein that comes out looks almost like colorless, translucent jello. Once it's over 99% pure, Gorodetsky and his team apply it to tape that's actually commercially available. And he describes it almost like the process of putting spackle onto a wall. It's the coated tape that really takes on the squid-like camouflage properties.
Its ability to form structures that have unique optical properties is what makes it special. We found some interesting electrical properties as well. But for our camouflage studies, we're more focused on making films of it or layers on surfaces and then tuning those layers so that they reflect light of different wavelengths.
So once they've got this reflectin on a surface, can it actually change color like a squid?
Sort of. What Gorodetsky's working on and what other researchers at MIT are working on is something called dynamic camouflage. And the key part of this is change. So the material coated with squid protein appears to change colors because it's reflecting light. And it can actually also reflect infrared light, which most things can't. And that means that soldiers could use the tape to create patterns on uniforms that would help them identify members of a team in the dark and potentially reduce friendly fire.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so what does it look like when it changes color?
Professor Gorodetsky showed me a small piece of this coated material. It had kind of a metallic blue color to it, but if you were to put it on a red piece of paper, it would respond by reflecting that light back, and you'd see red.
That is amazing. Okay, so right now this is, you know, on a tape or sticker, sort of little pieces of coated material. Spin this forward. What happens down the road, and what are the sort of practical applications for this that could maybe change camouflage?
Well, this work is still in very early stages, and right now a lot of the funding actually comes from the Department of Energy and a clothing company called Under Armour.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's because the same elements that cause reflectin to manipulate the light could be part of designs for clothes that help people regulate their body temperature to keep cool during a workout or to keep warm with a really thin jacket.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. But Gorodetsky says that the energy and camouflage applications are two sides of the same coin. Dynamic camouflage is in the future, even though some of it sounds totally sci-fi right now.
In the next decade or so, maybe something along the lines of a color-changing shirt. I think I look even further, maybe, you know, even 30, 40 years down the line, where you could have a shirt that looks more like formal wear in one situation and then changes to look more like an informal t-shirt in another situation.
That is amazing. Eliza, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
The this next story of invisibility is about pain you can't see, or rather pain in limbs that have been lost or amputated, often known as phantom limb pain, something many veterans and other amputees wrestle with, and it's very hard to treat. Our next guest's work involves treating that pain by placing electrodes on the remaining limb stump. In this case, let's say it's an arm. The electrodes send signals into a computer algorithm. That algorithm creates a virtual arm on a computer screen. The patient can see it and control it just like the lost limb, and it helps alleviate pain. Max Ortiz-Catalan is the research scientist behind this at Chalmers University in Gothenburg, Sweden, where he recorded himself. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you explain how phantom limb pain feels? What do patients you work with say to describe it?
Your brain has a map of every part of your body. And you use this map so you can move, and then you can have sensory input from all the sensors you have around, you know, your hands, your feet, like all around your body. When you suffer an amputation, and that can be, you know, a leg or an arm or a breast, that part of the brain, it stopped receiving sensory input, and in the case of the limbs, it stopped producing motor control. Although you have no longer that limb or that part of your body, you still perceive it as being there, and that's why they call it phantom. The problem comes when you start feeling pain in that part of your body that you no longer have. And then it's a very difficult situation because it's very hard to treat. There are some treatments that work for some patients, but so far it hasn't been found something that helps everybody. And if you think about it, if you feel an itching sensation in your leg, but you no longer have the leg, it's hard to scratch it. And that's what makes it difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that just feels so awful. It's making me kind of jumpy in my seat thinking about it.
The kind of pain is, you know, when we talk about pain, we use a singular, but it's really a plural. The pain is a lot of different sensations, and you can feel a burning sensation or a cutting, or you can feel the joint, different kind of pain that you can feel that are related to tissue damage.
You are working on this in your lab. How do you see this expanding out to the wider world or affecting more people's lives?
That's a very important part, I think. I think researchers, we should always think about how, if we have something that can benefit people, how can we make it available for more? So we're running a clinical trial in 4 hospitals at the moment. We're looking at patients that have the same background of the most difficult cases. And the rationale is that if we can help the most difficult cases, this probably will work for, you know, all cases.
If you were trying to use this in, you know, a patient's daily life, how much would it cost?
I don't have an amount exactly in my mind, but we don't think it's going to be very expensive. And that's one of the things, you know, the reasons why we're working with this technology, because you could have been using head-mounted displays, you know, displays people use for virtual reality and so on. And that would be a lot more expensive, but it's not really necessary for the objective we want to achieve, that is basically using the screen of your computer as a mirror so you can see yourself with an arm and you can move it. That we can do with a regular webcam and so on. And once we develop the software, it's, you know, copy-paste kind of thing.
You're clearly pretty passionate about this. How did you get so interested in it?
When I was working with this, I met patients that were suffering of phantom limb pain, and then I started reading about it, and I realized we don't really even understand this kind of pain. We don't really understand, well, neuropathic pain. There is a bit of a stigma on it because it's a pain on a part of your body that you no longer have, and people will say, like, you know, that's only in your head. And the thing is that all pain is in your head. So this is a very real sensation for the patient suffering. We came up with this idea, and now we try to disseminate it, and hopefully it can help people.
Max Ortiz-Catalan is a research scientist at Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg, Sweden. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
We're now going to bring you the story of someone who was invisible to the outside world for several years. We're going to refer to her as Rama, her first name. She is a victim of trafficking. She's in her 60s, and in 2003, she was sold by her late husband's family in southern India to a doctor in California. She was essentially housebound and worked for no pay for more than 3 years with no idea where she was. She was able to escape and then worked a series of jobs below minimum wage in other doctors' homes for a few more years. In 2012, she got help from the South Asian Network, a nonprofit. You'll hear her call it SAN. They also helped her get what's called a T visa for victims of trafficking. You'll hear Rama's voice and the voice of a translator from SAN. Hi, Rama. Welcome to the show.
Miss Lizzie, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
What would you like people to know about what happened to you?
Before
SAN came into my life, I have worked in many doctors' houses. I worked in their houses. They would ask me to cook. I would cook very well. They would ask me to clean. I would clean very well. But when it came to paying money, why do we have to pay you so much? They wouldn't ask this question if it was a person that they were paying outside for some other job. But why me? When they had to pay me, why would they treat me less? And in some houses where I worked, I would save whatever little I had, and I would keep it. They look at my bags, they would look at everything, and they would say, I have stolen money, I've stolen things, and they would take that away from me and go. The fact that, you know, now I have papers puts me at ease. Every day I would hear, like, you don't have papers. We could do anything to you, and nobody will know. I was in this fear that I would die. Somebody would kill me because I didn't have papers. But that all changed when SAN got me these papers. And now I have everything, and I can show the whole world I have the right papers. Nobody can touch me now. The fact that I'm here after all these years and after seeing all the educated and learned people, the way they treated me, we all need to be treated with love and respect. We are human beings like anybody else.
When you got that visa, was that a relief? What was that like?
When I got the visa, my life changed. Everything changed for me. It was like a new life for me. I got a new job, and I'm doing good. I don't want anybody to do harm me or kill me. I want to die on my own accord. I want to die on my own terms. I don't want anybody to define that for me.
What's it like to earn your own money? I would imagine that probably feels pretty good right now.
I love that I'm earning my own, living, and I love it. I don't have to stretch my hand and ask for someone to help me.
What kind of work do you do, and what's it like?
I do daycare for children, for elderly people. I do gardening. I do cleaning. As I have not studied much, I do whatever I can do with the skills that I have.
What do people not understand or not see about your life?
The way people understand is somebody who has a big job or somebody who's employs another person. They don't understand what another person who does a job for them. They don't see that person as a person. They see somebody who is doing their work for them. Why doesn't somebody see doing a job like mine, that I'm a human being? I'm a person just like anybody else. Why don't people who have jobs and money and education see that? If you treat another person like a human being, and if you give respect and give the money they deserve, I've not found many people in the world like that. You show me whether you have found people like that.
Just thinking about all that you've been through, Rama, how are you able to be so strong?
Adi chinnapati nundi kashtalu.
Since childhood, I have seen many tough situations in my life. I've seen people getting killed, people killing other people, killing people, and I've seen people being tortured and abused. I've seen all that. There are too many stories in me. I wish if I had a little education, I would write those novels and I would entertain people with my stories. I'm not going to close the book prematurely.
Thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lacey. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Earlier this week, when we mentioned that our theme for the week's show is invisibility, one person got very excited. Patty Hirsch, our resident explainer, said we absolutely had to talk about something called the invisible hand. It sounds like a bad horror movie, but no, we're going to get a bit more high concept. So we're bringing in Patty. Welcome back, Mr. Hirsch.
Thanks, Lizzie.
All right, so what is the invisible hand? It sounds kind of creepy.
It is not creepy. It is actually a force for good, or at least that's how Adam Smith, the grandfather of economics, used to think about it. In the late 1700s, he came up with this idea that the selfish behavior of individuals can result, or does result generally, in good things happening in the wider economy.
So this is like translating Ayn Rand, or you want to be more modern, Gordon Gekko, like greed is good?
Kind of greed is good. Here's what Adam Smith actually said. Here's the quote, right, from his book. The rich are led by an invisible hand to make nearly the same distribution of the necessaries of life, which would have been made had the earth been divided into equal portions among all its inhabitants, and thus, without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interest of society. So in other words, what he's saying is that rich people want what's best for themselves because they are selfish. So they crank up production in their businesses in order to make lots of money, and then they spend up a storm buying stuff. So of course, high production of goods means lower prices of those goods, which means more people can afford them. Meanwhile, more consumption of stuff by the wealthy means more jobs created by that stuff. So all good, right?
Maybe. I mean, this is kind of pure capitalist theory with a trickle-down bent.
Yeah.
And why, if it's been around since the 1700s, are you psyched now?
Well, I'm psyched now because I'm starting to see what I consider to be invisible hand inflation.
What in the world is that?
This theory of the invisible hand is being really abused right now, mostly by politicians, because we're in the run-up to presidential elections, but also by private equity people. Right, private equity firms load up on debt and they use it to buy struggling companies. Then they gut those companies, sack a bunch of the staff, and then sell off what's left of the operation to the public or to another company. And they walk away with this big check. Now, it's this very painful and obviously greedy process. But when you hear private equity bosses talk about their business, they always talk about like the net benefit to the economy, how good they are being to the economy.
I was recently reporting in Silicon Valley, and I felt like I heard this a lot. Oh, we're saving the world. We're making things a better place. But this also doesn't address the fact that some of these companies collapse. There are lost jobs in the wake. I mean,
yeah.
What happens afterwards?
Well, what happens afterwards a lot of the time is, as you say, these companies collapse and creditors are left without their money. People are left without jobs. There are all sorts of problems with this.
So let's turn this on its head. Why do you think, because I can hear it in your voice, that Adam Smith may be wrong here?
Well, I'm not saying that Adam Smith was wrong. I mean, he was talking in the late 1700s, a very, very different world to the one we live in now. He also talked about the distribution of the necessaries of life. And I would argue that the necessaries of life these days are pretty poorly distributed. That, you know, you look at our cities, they've got large and growing homeless populations. We've got large segments of the population that are underemployed. So I think that, you know, we've got a very, very different world today. And Adam Smith's rationale or his philosophy is kind of being twisted because the world is not the same. The same rules don't apply.
Patty Hirsch is a senior editor and the host of our Whiteboard Explainer series. Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Last week, we asked you, our listeners, about invisibility and your money. What your money's doing when you can't see it, or maybe where you hide it. A bunch of you wrote in to MarketplaceWeekend.org with a variety of stories. For Victoria Cully, keeping her money out of sight means keeping it in the bank. For Lee Cornell, a 403b and a Roth IRA are perfect hiding places. And then we heard more creative options. Tiana Cove stashes cash in the broken coin holder in her car, and Nancy Miller keeps her, yes, I'm quoting, cold, hard cash hidden behind the vegan food in her freezer, where she said people were less likely to look. Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Okay, Jill, what's your reaction?
The freezer one, I just want to say the freezer one is a little Sopranos-esque.
Put on your personal advisor hat for me a second and just react to these. What do you think?
Okay, so not surprising. You know, when I was a financial advisor, I had some clients who would ask me questions like, well, let's just say a friend of mine had 10 grand in cash. What would I do with that 10 grand in cash? The idea that you keep it in your house scares me a tiny bit simply because, okay, let's say your house burns down and you do have 10 grand there and your emergency money just, you can't claim it. You can't say, oh, you know what, insurance company? I had 10 grand behind my vegan burgers and my tofu pups. You can't claim that. So yeah. The first thing that I get nervous about is, you know, something bad happens. Tiana gets into a car accident. The whole car is ruined. Her money's gone. Like, do I really want to do that? So I certainly am more in the Victoria camp that if I wanted safe money, as long as it was less than $250,000, you know, so you have your FDIC protection and you want access to it and you really don't care about interest, because obviously if you have cash, you don't care about interest. I'm sort of thinking like a bank, a CD, a money market. That seems fine to me. I love the retirement account answer.
Okay, but what all of these things get at, even if they're different, is this concept of taking money out of our tangible grasp because we know we're going to be tempted. Why do we do it this way?
Well, I mean, because we're human beings and we are emotional and we have to play games with ourselves sometimes. This goes back to having like a Christmas savings account. You know, that was a very old-fashioned concept. You know, take $5 out of your checking or regular savings. You put it over here into this special Christmas account so that when the holidays come around, you've got your money ready for your presents. And somehow in our minds, and I've spoken to some behavioral economists about this, when you separate money, it is actually a bit easier to control yourself.
So let's say you have a 401k or something like that. What's happening to that money when you can't see it?
Well, I mean, presumably you are being smart about how you are allocating that money. Number one, you've got to understand fees come out. Number two, you are responsible for investing this money. And that means you actually do have to pay attention. You do have to look at the choices. And I always give this advice, and that is when in doubt, pick a nice diversified portfolio of index funds. Why index funds? Because they're the cheapest funds in every plan. So if you want to keep those costs down, use the index funds if they're offered.
If you're putting your money in a retirement account, how often should you check in? And is there a standard return you should be trying to shoot for?
Well, you know, there's no standard return. Return is based on you. You know, am I close to needing this money? Am I a really wimpy investor? How do I want to organize my investments? Do I want to have an asset allocation that's tilted towards growth? Well, great. Do I want to have something that's really safe? Am I getting close to retirement and I want to have everything in a fixed account? Those are the questions that we answer in terms of what return to expect. Generally speaking, you know, if you're a diversified investor, I think that, you know, in this day and age, even though we've seen the S&P 500 go up by 250% in the last 6 years, if you reinvested your dividends, that's not something to expect that will be repeated. Hmm. So I'm thinking, you know, if you're looking at the next 10 years, you know what? If you're shooting for 4, 5, 6% return, fantastic. And besides that, I think that in terms of how often you should look at it, I always like to say to people, you know, if you're checking your retirement account every single day, you've got something wrong with you. You need something else in your life. You really need a hobby. Quarterly is a good time to check in. And if you can do the auto rebalancing, the thing that it will also be really helpful in doing is forcing you to sell high and buy low.
Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Next week's show is all about ceilings, and we want to know, what are the ceilings you've bumped up against in your career? Tell us what happened. You can reach us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go, or on Marketplace's Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Returning now from what's in our wallets, or freezers, to larger invisible economies, like black markets. The website statisticbrain.com tracks all sorts of numbers, and they tally the value of black markets. Their overall figure is that there's about $625 billion of illicit trade in the U.S. each year. And yes, some of those numbers can be hard to come by, but for a snapshot of the black market, we're turning to Seth Hardin. He's the CEO of StatisticBrain.com. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Lizzie. Thank you.
So if I came to this country having no idea about any of this and just said, like, hey, what's on the black market? What's bought? What's sold? What would you tell me?
You would think we're a bunch of illegal gambling, cocaine using, movie pirating, counterfeit alcohol smuggling people, I guess.
Whoa! Why don't you quickly run me through, say, the top five things on the black market and how much they're worth by your numbers?
Number five, movie piracy is at $25 billion U.S. market value.
A year?
Yeah, $25 billion a year is what we're looking at as far as the price of what those products would be if they were sold on the real market. Then at number four, we're at cocaine, which is, that's a $35 billion a year industry revenue that is being made from the sale of cocaine. Next on the list at number three is marijuana, which is at $82 billion. Then we've got illegal gambling, which is at $150 billion. And then at the top of the list is product counterfeiting at $225 billion, which obviously shows that people like to buy brand name products, and they seems to show that they really don't care whether or not they are actually legitimate.
How do you figure that out? That's going to be kind of hard to actually come up with the statistics.
A lot of them are based off of estimation done by bureaus. Some of them are obviously the drug trade ones. It's really hard in that area because it's a lot of underground traded products. So a lot of them are estimations done by seizures. Sometimes they can get a certain market size based off of how much they've been able to come across when they've done major drug busts or warehouse seizures. So that's a good way to gauge kind of what the market demand is and then find out what the market value would be.
You've been compiling these numbers for a while. What's the most surprising thing that you've learned when you've been putting these lists together?
Anytime there's a number or information that supports somebody's position, they're super excited about that number and it's absolutely accurate. But if there's a number that opposes somebody's position, that number is wrong. We follow our social media and see how people use these statistics to argue their side.
Yeah, lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Seth Hardin is the CEO of Statistic Brain and has compiled the monetary value of different black markets. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Our last story of invisibility takes place in the Catholic monastery of Dominican nuns. To find out what's hidden behind the high walls of cloistered life, we turned both to Maura Weiler, who has studied cloistered nuns for 3.5 years for her forthcoming book, Contrition. You'll hear her voice alternate with Sister Mary Pia, a cloistered nun at the monastery, which is located somewhere you might not expect. Here's Maura.
the Monastery of the Angels in Los Angeles.
We're very close to Hollywood. In fact, we're only a block away from Hollywood Boulevard. We're just at the bottom of the Hollywood Hills. That's where the monastery has been here for, 90 years. So
generally, either they're entirely obscured behind some sort of a screen or a wall, or partially obscured. So you can't actually see them face to face.
It's not actually, dear, for the point of being hidden. We want to withdraw from the business of the world so that it will not distract us. And in doing that, we enter a cloister, which necessarily keeps us out of the public eye. You know, it's not that we want to be hidden.
And what they look like are they wear the traditional habit.
And we wear that every day.
So you really only see their face. And as I've discovered over time, visiting with various orders, that also means that they look really young because they've don't spend a whole lot of time in the sun. And when they are out in the sun, they tend to have a veil on. So they've really cornered the market on eternal youth.
So I've been dressed this way since the year 1951, when I was clothed with the habit.
They make pumpkin bread and...
When I was in the bakery in 1969, we started pumpkin bread going at that time. So it's been a long time. It's been going.
Well, I was certainly very curious about how they did things like go to the doctor or the dentist or, you know, get new shoes, etc.
We go to the doctor, the dentist. We don't leave the monastery unless it's an important meeting like that. And we usually have one of the sisters drive us to our appointment.
In 2009, their oven broke and they couldn't make a living.
That stopped our pumpkin bread production, but it only stopped for a little while. It was put back in order. There was a cost to it.
That's a time when they had to kind of reach out to the public and have a few articles written about them to remind people that they were there and that they needed support. And a lot of people know they're there and appreciate them, but, you know, once in a while they kind of have to knock and say, hey, we're here and we're praying and we'd like some help. But mostly they're self-sustaining.
We pay every cost. Our monastery has its own banking account.
After spending so much time with them, I take comfort in knowing that they're there and knowing that at certain times of day, these prayers are happening and I can mentally join in from wherever I am.
I talk to many people on the phone each day and they have problems. They want prayers. We're praying for them and I tell them the whole community is praying for them. But this happens many times during the day, really.
They do all day long. That's what they've devoted their lives to because they feel that that can make a difference.
People in Hollywood need prayers. I've learned that one thing from being here.
And that's our show for the week. Next week, we'll explore ceilings of the economic variety. We'll go inside your wallet and ride to outer space. We'll also be talking about the ceilings in your career, and we want to hear about them. As you climb the ladder, where are you bumping your head? Let us know by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. Visit the Marketplace Facebook page or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and the lovely and talented Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks so much for listening. This is APM.